Unless you've spent time in some of the remote Aboriginal communities, most of us have no idea of how hard that life can be. But Andrew Stoyanovsky does. The self-described manic community worker was based at Yuendumu, 300 k's northwest of Alice Springs, for 11 years. In that time, he was instrumental in establishing a highly successful and much lauded program to combat petrol sniffing at Mount Theo, an outstation. And it was only with great regret that he finally moved away from the people and a landscape that he was by then deeply connected to. He's written a book about these experiences. It's a real rip-roaring yarn called Dog Ear Cafe, and he joins me now. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Richard.
There are some wild times and some funny times in these stories. A lot goes on in the Tanami Desert.
Yeah, a lot does go on. And I guess for me as a white fella, it was a very fascinating place to live. You know, I got to live in a community where people actually spoke an Australian language most of the time, which is pretty rare experience as an Australian to hear that. Mm. And I got to go to ceremonies. I got to dance, like, and do things that you know, are the essence of the Australian landscape.
And just to put people in the picture, Yuendumu, it's a pretty substantial place, isn't it?
Yeah, Yuendumu is described as the New York of central desert Aboriginal communities. It's got 1,000 people living there, and it's got a lot of different organisations. It's the home of the Walpri Media Association that created the Bush Mechanics TV series. Mm-hmm. It's also the home of the Wallakolongu Artists Association that, you know, exports art from the desert all around the world.
Now, the petrol sniffing, was that the biggest problem the community was facing or just the most obvious one?
In 1993, half the teenagers of Yuendumu were sniffing petrol. So it was the biggest problem that the community was facing, because when petrol sniffing becomes entrenched in a community, you end up with gangs of young people roaming the community off their heads, you know, armed with knives and axes and threatening and intimidating people. In some communities in the Pitjantjatjara lands in South Australia, community workers used expressions such as the sniffers are holding the community to ransom.
Mm. And when it's that high a percentage, it becomes almost the default, doesn't it? It's where you go if you want to be part of the crowd.
Well, petrol sniffing was the cool and groovy activity for teenagers in Yuendumu in the early 1990s. It was like if you went to the sniffer houses, even if you weren't a sniffer, you'd go there to pick up chicks. It was where the action was.
Now, you were a youth liaison worker, so petrol sniffing was your focus. And the sniffers, well, they didn't really appreciate that, did they?
My relationship with the sniffers was quite funny. I was living in Yuendumu. I was 25 years old. And, you know, some of the sniffers were in their early 20s. So one of my best friends, Solomon Langdon, he was a sniffer, but we used to have deep and meaningful conversations about girlfriends and wives and life. So I was like a peer at one level, but because I worked with the tribal elders in identifying who was sniffing and then taking them to an outstation, I was also like an authority figure.
Mm. And that meant sometimes there was a bit of violence with you as the target, didn't it?
Yeah. I think, you know, people, like, the sniffers were upset that their right to sniff was being challenged, and, you know, when their parents tried to force them to the outstation, they'd pick up a knife or an axe or a big bit of wood, and when I was there accompanying tribal elders, they thought, well, you know, it's probably this white fella stirring things up, we better target him.
So Mount Theo was this outstation. It had been used to keep young people away from petrol, and there were all sorts of trials and tribulations involved in getting it going again. But there were two people instrumental to it, Peggy Brown and Johnny Hooker Creek. Can you tell me about them?
Okay, well, Peggy Brown was a woman who had been living at Mount Theo with her husband in the early 1990s, and their Land Rover broke down, and so they were forced to live in Yuendumu. And during the time that they were living in Yuendumu, her children began sniffing petrol, and so she really wanted to move back to the outstation. And at that time, Yuendumu was growing increasingly despairing because none of the strategies to stop petrol sniffing, such as night patrols and outreach youth programs, were stopping it completely. And then there was a small community meeting of those who still felt that we could do something, because a lot of people had given up. And Peggy attended that meeting and she said, if the community will support me to move back to the outstation, I will look after any petrol sniffer. So that's Peggy's story. Johnny Hooker Creek is a man, I think he was born in about 1922. He actually was with his parents when they ran away from the massacre posse of the Coniston Massacre, which took place in 1928 when Constable William Murray led a group of white fellas into Walpiri camps in the Landa region area and basically shot people indiscriminately. And Johnny and his parents escaped that through hiding out at Mount Theo. He then went on after contact with white fellas to become a drover and a stockman, and in his older years, like from the age of 70 onwards, he was living at Mount Theo as other people were, like Peggy, and he decided that he would also take up the cause of helping to look after the young people who were sniffing petrol out there.
The heart and soul of it, really.
Yeah.
Now, talk to me about vehicles, Andrew, because there are many pages in your book devoted to vehicle politics, and it's very, very complicated.
Okay, I'll tell you a vehicle story. Sending petrol sniffers to outstations is not a new or radical or cutting-edge idea. It's been kicked around since the 1970s, and lots of communities in the top end of Australia and in the desert have tried it. And when I was a university student studying anthropology and Aboriginal studies, I would read about these programs, and they would invariably collapse due to infighting over resources and vehicles. And I guess part of the politic of it is that people who live in Walpiri society have particular cultural relationships. Some of them are avoidance relationships, which is the classic one is mother-in-law and son-in-law, where a person can't talk to their mother-in-law and they can't even be in the same room as their mother-in-law. So you go to Yuendumu and you see people standing outside the shop waiting for their mother-in-law to leave the shop before they enter the shop. So that's one sort of relationship. People also have what I would describe as can't-say-no relationships, where there are certain kin and certain people who conduct ceremonies that other people have to say yes to. They're absolutely obliged to. So that means, you know, if that person asks for money or if they ask for food or blankets, the person who's got a can't-say-no relationship has to say yes to them. This creates difficulties when you're trying to manage a program and say, I would give Johnny Hooker Creek the Toyota, and it would be classed as his Mount Theo Toyota because he's the senior traditional owner of that country. And then if somebody who had a can't-say-no relationship with him came up and said, look, we want to use that Toyota to go to Lajamanu for sorry business, or we want to use that Toyota to go to Nirrapi to visit sick relative, Johnny Hooker Creek couldn't say no to that because of his cultural relationship. There's no way he could get out of that. So that created problems when you have a vehicle that's meant to be stationed at an outstation so that it's an emergency vehicle in case a kid gets bitten by a snake, but then another relative comes along and says, look, I really need to take it to Nirrapi to visit my family. And you've got a man who, culturally, it's against his law to say no.
So you get round that in a way, if you can, by saying, well, actually, no, it's Andrews, and Andrews a well, stroppy white fella.
We had problems because initially our first program vehicle was granted through mining royalties through the Land Council, and they provided no grant guidelines for the vehicle. And then people would take the vehicle here, there and everywhere, and despite having committee meetings that would write rules, those rules would get immediately broken because of the power of can't-say-no relationships, you know, which are enduring Walpiri law. So then other family members or other community members would complain, and they're saying, look, you know, that vehicle's gone there and it's actually meant to be a work vehicle. And it created the very infighting and tensions between people that have destroyed petrol sniffing outstation programs all across Australia. So I guess I thought long and hard about that, and the way that myself and my co-worker Liam Campbell worked a way around that was that I actually bought a vehicle with my own money, as opposed to it being an official program vehicle or an official outstation vehicle. With that vehicle that I bought with my own money, I then painted my name on the side of it, and I painted other pictures. I got my daughter's footprints on the side of it, and it was very clearly my vehicle. There was no mythology that it could be anyone else's. I then loaned that vehicle to Johnny Hooker Creek, and I said, I'm the owner of this vehicle, and you can have it at that outstation, but no one can take it from you without asking me, because I'm the owner. So next time a relative came up and said, Hooker Creek, we really want to borrow that vehicle to go to Lajimanu, he can say, look, if it was mine, I'd give it to you, but I can't give it to you because it's not mine. And it kind of gets him off that cultural yes. hook. Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think that's very well explained. On Life Matters today, my guest is Andrew Sternofsky. He's author of, we're hearing about his time in the Central Desert, in the Tanami, working at Yuendumu and the outstation Mount Theo on a program for getting young people off petrol sniffing. It's told in his book, Dog Ear Cafe. Some of the young people who picked on you and your family, because you were there with your family, despite yeah. the fact that you were there to help them, it was full on, but they were honest about it in an odd kind of way. They'd admit to it. Yeah, I stole that money.
Oh, yeah, you're talking about that story. Well, I have a very close friendship with Austin, you know, who's one of the kids who was a petrol sniffer, but, you know, he'd come over to my house and then I'd notice that $40 was missing. And when I questioned him about it the next day, you know, he'd say, oh, can I have lunch with you? I go, not till you pay back that money. And he'd go, oh, and I go, now, Austin, did you steal $40 or was it $45? And he'd go, oh, it was only $40. So, yeah, he confessed he wouldn't want to have to pay back $45.
Didn't he answer the phone when he was robbing your house too?
He did. He came into my house once. We'd just come back from Alice Springs and my wife, Vesna, was visiting her friend Lucy and I was running swimming pool. And when we came back to the house, we noticed that the salami was gone, the chocolate was gone, and the phone stunk of petrol. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's probably Austin. And then later on, I spoke to my mother on the telephone and she said, well, I rang earlier in the afternoon and someone answered the phone and they said, where's Vesna? And he said, oh, she's up the road. Where's Andrew? He's at the swimming pool. And my mum said, who are you? And the thief said, I'm Austin. Yeah.
Now, the petrol sniffing program was ultimately completely successful.
It was. It's like incredibly successful. We had 70 kids in our community sniffing petrol, half the teenage population. And that was in 1993, and by 1999, summer of 98-99, we actually had our first petrol-free summer. And in the winter of 1999, we had the chairperson of the Australian Council on Drugs coming out, you know, nominated by the Prime Minister, and we'd run out of petrol sniffers. And we were like, oh, God, are they going to defund our program? You know, we've got no more sniffers. By 2002, sniffing had completely finished in Yuendumu, but what was quite amazing was that the ex-sniffers decided that they wanted to work to make Yuendumu such a funky place that the next generation of kids wouldn't want to sniff.
So it's now, it's evolved into a leadership program effectively, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's like it's a mentoring program. They have night school. They've established a half Olympic-sized swimming pool in Yuendumu that's staffed by young Walfrey people who've been trained. They have a mechanics workshop that provides training for young Walfrey people. And, you know, the young people who were sniffers started this project called Jarrupidgety, which means strong voices. And they started in collaboration with a young university student from the ANU called Carissa Pruce. And together, they went on to create what is probably the biggest focus of Mount Theo program now, which has had like some quite notable successes. Like in the first year of operation, a young girl called Pollyanne Dixon, who used to collapse on the classroom floor after sniffing petrol all night, won the Triple J Haywire Short Story Award for her story of wow. about life, petrol sniffing and strong voices. And then I guess the most famous graduate of the Strong Voices Project, who comes from the generation after sniffing, from the petrol-free generation, is the AFL footballer Liam Jarrah, who spent 3 or 4 years working with this Jarrupidgety Strong Voices Project before being signed to Melbourne Football Club. And he was, I think he's the Northern Territory Young Australian of the Year this year.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. Now, you've recently been back, haven't you? And I know you've been a few times since you left, but how was that to go back?
To go back and to carry this book, okay, I carried this book and I took it from my home near Maruya in New South Wales by the Jura River, and I drove to Melbourne and I caught a plane to Alice Springs, and then I drove out to Yuendumu, and then I walked the 140 kilometres out to Mount Theo, which took 5 days and 4 nights camping at different sacred sites on the way and having people come out and visit me. And then I began in the moonlit morning and walked to Mount Thayer the last 20 kilometres, and as Peggy saw my figure in the distance, she started wailing. And then I handed this book over to her and I said, you know, Hooker Creek was sitting beside her by the fire, you know, cooking tea. I said, this is our story. And she could look at the photos, and then we started reading parts of the story. And it was very emotional, you know. It was like the proper way to do things. But the most emotional incident I did was when I handed the book over to a young man called Michael Jappeljerry Wayne, who was sitting with his mother, Lee Wayne. And his sister was pregnant and she was a petrol sniffer. And we had to take her out to Mount Theo even though she was 8 months pregnant, because we didn't want her to keep poisoning her baby with petrol. And, you know, we ended up having to do a flying doctor evac to get her into hospital to have that baby in the middle of the night. She came back to Yindamu, she started sniffing petrol again, she dumped the baby with the grandparents. We had to take her back to Mount Theo because we thought if she's in Yindamu sniffing petrol, she might do what kids do in the South Australian country, where the young mothers who are petrol sniffers actually soothe their babies to sleep with petrol-soaked rags. And we didn't want to see that happen in Yindamu. So we took his sister out to Mount Theo. And of course, you know, her breasts were full of milk and she was in pain. And so she tried to commit suicide many times when she was out there, hanging herself at night. And, you know, then she got up when we kept doing a vigil to stop her from hanging herself, and she ran off into the bush with a knife and threatened to stab herself or anyone who came near her. And it took 6 days of us just always doing this vigil before we took her into mental health in Alice Springs and said, you know, can you help us? And they went, oh, she's all right, and sent her back to Yindamu, and she started sniffing again. Michael Wayne became a leading voice in this Jarrabidji Strong Voices project, and together with his mother and his aunties, just the love that they poured into that girl somehow changed her, you know. And when I sat down with Michael and his mother and I gave him the book and we told this story, tears were streaming down our faces, because it's the story of not only what Mount Theo has, you know, did in kind of intervening, but in the power of what that young man did, how he transformed his own life from being a petrol sniffer to being someone who saves other people's lives and to being a community leader.
That's a story of redemption, and it's quite a good place, I think, to finish. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us
today. No worries. Thank you, Richard.
Andrew Stoyanovsky's the author of Dog Ear Cafe, and it's been put out by Hybrid Publishing. In a moment on Life Matters, meet siblings who've shared more than most, Margot and Miko.